A couple of months ago, I saw a tweet from the writer Vinay Patel. He wrote,
"Frankenstein the book is perhaps one of the greatest pieces of shade in literary history. Young woman stuck in the middle of nowhere with dude bro poets, write story about man whose act of creative arrogance is so misguided it kills people. What you writing over there, Mary?" "Oh, nothing. Don't let me disturb you from finding new metaphors for your dick."
Social media posts about Frankenstein's composition are a genre unto themselves. A couple of years ago, Tumblr user NanaSuch wrote,
"Sometimes I want to go up to the people who insist that feminism and progressive values are ruining science fiction and remind them that their genre exists because a teenage girl was stuck at a house party and decided that inventing science fiction sounded more appealing than yet another tiresome threesome with Lord Byron."
If these comments are exaggerations, they're just barely so. Percy Shelley and Lord Byron were undeniably two of the greatest literary dude bros of the early 19th century, and the free love ethos that they and their cohort shared is the stuff of infamy. It's no wonder that the summer that Mary spent with them in 1816, which marked the beginning of Frankenstein's composition, has been elevated to the status of myth. And it's a remarkable irony that those two prolific dude bros proposed a story-writing contest for which neither of them would actually complete stories, but that would prompt not one, but two of the most influential ghost stories of all time. This is Frankenstein's Afterlife. It started with a volcano. On April 5th, 1815, Mount Tambora, a volcano in what is today Indonesia, erupted. It was one of six massive volcanic eruptions to have taken place in the past 6 years, each of which spewed enough ash into the atmosphere to alter global weather patterns. But Mount Tambora was the granddaddy of them all. Over the course of 10 days, it ejected 24 cubic miles of material, making it the largest volcanic eruption in over 1,600 years, and one of the top five in the last 5,000 years. This once-in-a-millennium volcano spewed enough particulate into the atmosphere to dim the sun, causing average global temperatures to decrease by more than 1 degree Celsius the following year. Agriculture, which had already experienced challenges in the past several years due to the effects of other recent volcanoes, suffered greatly, and famine was prevalent throughout North America, Europe, and Asia. Western Europe, which was already reeling from the effects of the Napoleonic Wars, bore some of the worst of it. In much of Europe, temperatures in 1816 were 3 degrees Celsius lower than they normally would have been. Massive storms caused major floods, and frost in August killed even more crops. It came to be known as the Year Without Summer. Apocalypse was in the air, as evident in Lord Byron's poem, Darkness, written that year.
"The bright sun was extinguished, and the stars did wander darkling in the eternal space. Rayless and pathless, and the icy earth swung blind and blackening in the moonless air. Morn came and went, and came, and brought no day, and men forgot their passions in the dread of this, their desolation."
Lord Byron had become a literary luminary after the publication of the first two cantos of his narrative poem, Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, in 1812. Byron met Annabella Milbank in 1813, married her in 1815, and had a daughter, Ada, in December of that year. But that entire time, he continued to have affairs with a number of men and women, including his half-sister, Augusta Lee. Annabella came to believe that Byron was insane. She left him in January, taking Ada, and was legally separated in March. Reeling from the separation and from the scandals around his affairs, Byron left England in April. He took up residence in Villa Diodati, a mansion on Lake Geneva in Switzerland. He intended to work on the third canto of Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, but he was frequently interrupted by visits from his entourage. His mistress, Claire Claremont, Claire's half-sister, Mary Godwin, and Mary's lover, the poet Percy Shelley, as well as Byron's personal physician, John Polidori. His neighbors in Switzerland all assumed that these five English tourists were spending their evenings engaged in diabolical orgies, which very well might have been true. But somehow I doubt the evening's entertainments were particularly debauched on the nights that Polidori was around. John William Polidori was born on December 7, 1795, the eldest son of the Italian scholar Gaetano Polidori and an English governess, Anna Maria Pierce. He attended medical school at the University of Edinburgh, where he wrote a thesis on sleepwalking, and he earned his doctorate in 1815, at the young age of 19. In 1816, shortly before Byron was to leave for England, Polidori became his personal physician, and Byron's publisher, Charles Murray, paid Polidori £500 to accompany the poet and keep a diary of their travels. Polidori, who had aspirations to literary fame, jumped at the opportunity. That year's climate disaster, however, put a damper on any plans to spend the summer exploring the bucolic Swiss countryside. Instead, Byron and Claire and Percy and Mary spent most of that rainy summer indoors, with Polidori finding himself in the unenviable position of the fifth wheel. Additionally, Mary and Claire were the descendants of literary royalty, while Percy was a rising star and Byron a bona fide celebrity. None of them particularly liked their less esteemed companion, and the four rarely passed up an opportunity to mock the young doctor, giving him the nickname Poor Polidori. Though he was living with Byron in Villa Diodati, he spent most of his time with members of Genevan society on the other side of the lake.
He used almost every day to cross the lake by himself in one of their flat-bottomed boats and return after passing the evening with his friends about 11 or 12 at night, often whilst the storms were raging in the circling summits of the mountains around.
Were it not for a sprained ankle, he might have been on the other side of the lake that night in June, when, after reading some tales from Phantasmagoriana, Byron proposed the now infamous story-writing competition. Polidori had trouble getting started on his ghost story. His first attempt was a tale that he would later publish as his only novel, Ernestus Berchtold, or The Modern Oedipus. Inspired by Byron's purportedly incestuous relationship with his half-sister, Augusta Lee, Ernestus Berchtold tells the story of a man who has been orphaned at a young age, who, as an adult, falls in love with a woman ultimately revealed to be his sister. In its final form, the novel is a dark and sophisticated work of Gothic fiction, with only a few light supernatural touches. The original story, as presented to the group in 1816, leaned much more heavily on the supernatural, and featured a woman who was cursed to have a skull for a head. It didn't leave much of an impression, at least not on Mary Shelley, who remembered it in her 1831 introduction to Frankenstein.
Poor Polidori had some terrible idea about a skull-headed lady, who was so punished for peeping through a keyhole. What to see, I forget. Something very shocking and wrong, of course. But when she was reduced to a worse condition than the renowned Tom of Coventry, he did not know what to do with her, and was obliged to dispatch her to the Tomb of the Capulets, the only place for which she was fitted.
At the same time that Polidori was working on his tale of the skull-headed lady, Byron began composing a story about an unnamed narrator traveling to Greece with his older friend, Augustus Darvel. Darvel is a mysterious and well-traveled man who inexplicably becomes frail when the travelers arrive at their destination. Lying in his sickbed, Darvel has the following exchange with the narrator.
This is the end of my journey and of my life. I came here to die, but I have a request to make, a command. For such my last words must be. You will observe it?
Most certainly, but have better hopes.
I have no hopes, nor wishes, but this. Conceal my death from every human being.
I hope there will be no occasion, that you will recover, and...
Peace! It must be so. Promise this.
I do.
Swear it by all that.
He here dictated an oath of great solemnity. There is no occasion for this. I will observe your request, and to doubt me is...
It cannot be helped. You must swear.
I took the oath.
After this exchange, Darvel dies. Byron never completed the story, but Polidori took inspiration from Byron's unfinished fragment and used it as the basis of his own story, The Vampire. Polidori left the manuscript for The Vampire behind when he returned to England in autumn of 1816. To this day, nobody knows how, 2 years later, the story ended up in London, in the hands of James Coburn, publisher of the New Monthly magazine. Coburn received the story, along with a letter recounting some of Byron and Shelley's exploits in Geneva, both of which he intended to publish. His editor, Alaric Watts, provided an introduction to the unattributed story.
The tale which accompanied the letter, we also present to our readers, without pledging ourselves positively for its authenticity, as the production of Lord Byron. We may, however, observe that it bears strong internal evidence of having been conceived by him.
Coburn, however, had no interest in equivocation. He struck out this passage, and instead published the story as A Tale Told by Lord Byron. It appeared on April Fool's Day, 1819. Both Byron and Polidori were quick to correct the magazine's error, but the misattribution doubtlessly increased the story's notoriety. The Vampire includes the same story beats as Byron's fragment, but Polidori fleshes out the beginning, includes a proper ending, writes in a third-person perspective, and changes the characters' names. In Polidori's tale, the protagonist, Aubrey, travels to Greece with an aristocratic acquaintance, Lord Ruthven. It's hard not to read the setup as autobiographical, with Aubrey standing in for Polidori and Lord Ruthven standing in for Byron. This is especially apparent in the passage where Aubrey is shocked by Lord Ruthven's predatory behavior towards young women.
His lordship was endeavoring to work upon the inexperience of the daughter of the lady whose house he chiefly frequented. Aubrey's eye followed him in all his windings, and soon discovered that an assignation had been appointed, which would most likely end in the ruin of an innocent, though thoughtless girl. Losing no time, he entered the apartment of Lord Ruthven, and abruptly asked him his intentions with respect to the lady, informing him at the same time that he was aware of his being about to meet her that very night. Lord Ruthven answered that his intentions were such as he supposed all would have upon such an occasion, and upon being pressed whether he intended to marry her, merely laughed.
Aubrey and Ruthven continue their travels, and Aubrey learns about local vampire lore from a Greek woman. Later, Ruthven is murdered in a robbery gone wrong, and as in Byron's story, he uses his dying breath to make his traveling companion swear an oath that he will not reveal his death to anyone. Aubrey returns to England, where, after a short time, Ruthven reappears. Ruthven begins courting Aubrey's sister, and he frequently enjoins Aubrey.
Remember your oath.
Aubrey suffers a nervous breakdown and, nearing death, writes a letter revealing the truth to his sister, who is to marry Lord Ruthven. But the letter arrives too late. On her wedding night, Aubrey's sister is discovered dead, drained of her blood, and Ruthven has vanished. Lord Ruthven was not the first vampire in English literature. He was preceded by earlier monsters. In Robert Southey's Talaba the Destroyer, Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Christabel, and Byron's own poem, The Giaour. But these characters were all bloated, shaggy, foul-smelling corpses, almost cartoonish figures of disgust. Polidori's innovation lies in creating a vampire who was of high social rank, not a beast stalking a small village, but an aristocrat moving through the salons of high society. In this change, he lays the groundwork for J.M. Rimer's Varney the Vampire, Sheraton Le Fanu's Carmilla, and of course, Bram Stoker's Dracula. In Polidori's hands, the vampire becomes a wealthy, beautiful, charismatic man. Vampirism transforms into a metaphor for class exploitation, and perhaps more significantly, a metaphor for sexual exploitation. Lord Ruthven is a literal lady killer, a serial womanizer who preserves his own youth by stealing the lives of virtuous members of the opposite sex. As the critics Robert Morrison and Chris Baldrick have put it,
for Polidori, the vampire story is conceived as a variant upon the moral tale, a tale designed principally as a warning, here against the fascinating power of the libertinism represented by his employer Byron.
I'm inclined to think of Byron as kind of the Hugh Hefner of the early 19th century. For both Byron and Hefner, it's tempting to romanticize their legacies as sexual revolutionaries, challenging the repressive social conservatism of their days. But in both cases, seeing these sexual outlaws through such rose-colored glasses avoids confronting the very real harm that their libertinism caused. The degradation, gaslighting, and emotional abuse of all sorts that inevitably accompanies their vision of sexual freedom. One of Byron's paramours, Lady Caroline Lamb, famously described him as mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And this isn't just about Byron himself, but rather about the toxic masculinity that emerged out of the Romantics' fascination with the Byronic hero. Abuse and exploitation are intimately wrapped up with the lifestyle of the Byronic hero, and women are more often than not on the receiving end of that abuse. Percy Shelley exemplifies this toxic masculinity as well as Byron does. As was discussed in our previous episode, Percy Shelley's many affairs were a source of great sadness for Mary Shelley, and likely contributed to the suicides of both his first wife Harriet and Mary's half-sister, Fanny Imlay. John Polidori, the fifth wheel, became intimately acquainted with this culture of toxic masculinity when he found himself stuck in Geneva with these men, sitting inside to avoid the cold, rainy aftermath of a volcanic eruption on the other side of the world. And, like Mary, subtly mocking the creative arrogance of the literary dude bros, when he looked at these men, he didn't see heroes. He saw monsters. This podcast was written, narrated, and produced by Brian Motzke at the University of Michigan. Curtis Motzke helped design our cover art. Additional voice work was provided by Paula Motzke and Stephen Nelson. Steve has his own podcast, DIY Democracy, in which he tries to learn more about citizenship and improve civic engagement. In his latest episode, Mitigating the Harm from Bail, he interviewed Simon Cecil from the Minnesota Freedom Fund about providing low-level bail for people who are unable to pay. You can check it out by searching for DIY Democracy on iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice. And, once again, Mary Shelley was voiced by Mary Shelley. We can now be found on iTunes. Please rate, review, and share our podcast to help more people find the show. And one more thing. Claire Claremont didn't have any literary ambitions, but that ghost story competition involved four current or aspiring authors. What did Percy Shelley write? You'll find out in 2 weeks on the next episode of Frankenstein's Afterlife.